Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. At his campaign rally in Phoenix, Arizona earlier this week, a protester interrupted President Trump's remarks, prompting the president to make unscripted remarks about those who he says show up to march against him.
You know, they show up in the helmets and the black masks, and they've got clubs and they've got everything. Antifa!
That was the first time the president is known to have said the word Antifa. It stands for anti-fascism, and it's a movement that's been growing and has started to come to the attention of mainstream Americans. Antifa was part of the toxic mix that led to violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, almost 2 weeks ago. Shortly after the Charlottesville incidents, the president called out what he said was violence, quote, on all sides. He got massive criticism for that remark, which has been seen as creating an equivalence between neo-Nazis and white nationalists and those who were protesting racism and anti-Semitism. But some people do say Antifa, whose avowed members often show up armed, masked, and ready for violent confrontation, are not helping the cause. We're going to learn more about Antifa today and what the anti-fascism movement is in this country. Mark Bray is a visiting scholar and lecturer at Dartmouth College and author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. The book was due out at the beginning of September, but is being rushed through the process at the printer, given all the hubbub surrounding the movement. And Mark Bray is in high demand, as you might suspect. Has been making some waves in national debates as well. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I would really like you to start by helping us understand what fascism is so that we have a sense of what the anti-fascism movement is fighting against. And, you know, many people certainly know about fascism, but it's something that maybe isn't that well understood by many of us, and certainly younger generations. It's not something that we have thought much about in our lives. So can you describe what fascism is as the backdrop for counter and anti-fascism?
Sure. So defining fascism is a notoriously difficult enterprise because historically fascists and Nazis have adopted and discarded ideas and positions more readily than any other ideology. But there are some core trends that we can see that have continued through to far-right movements today, an extreme nationalism, a prioritization of the nation or the race, over all else in a sort of social Darwinian struggle for survival, a cult of masculinity, a focus on violence, and at least superficially a focus on creating a kind of class collaborationist society, so it's neither capitalist nor Marxist, but in actual practice, of course, historically fascists have ended up siding with industrialists against the working class. So that's the kind of framework, but it is important to clarify that anti-fascists organize against anti-Semites and Islamophobes and far-right organizations broadly, not only those that would fall in kind of a textbook definition of fascism.
Okay, so knowing what fascism is, and then a sense of this sort of totalitarian regimes and real shutdown of opposition and far-right nationalism, an adherence to the race often. So this is what Antifa is fighting against, anti-fascism.
That's right. And the other thing to understand is that most anti-fascists are socialists or anarchists or various different kinds of revolutionaries who also oppose the capitalist system and also want to build a more egalitarian society. So in that sense, the kind of domination of fascism is really quite different from the predominantly anarchist anti-authoritarian direction of anti-fascism.
Yeah. Can you go a little bit deeper into that? Because I think a lot of people would say, well, I'm anti-fascist, but that isn't the same as being Antifa.
Well, certainly anyone who's against fascism is in that sense an anti-fascist. And certainly listeners who disagree with the Antifa still should do whatever they can to try in their own ways to push back against the racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia of the far right. Historically, historians have tended to use the term anti-fascist or anti-fascism, sometimes in the way you're discussing in a loose sense of sort of all of the allies that fought against Hitler and Mussolini. But it's important to understand this specific political tendency to understand that for Antifa or for the kind of socialist anti-fascist perspective, it also entails an anti-capitalism and a sort of more thoroughgoing radical critique of society.
Well, there's also a possibility of violence or a not shying away from violence, or some would say a desire to foment violence that is part of the movement that is not necessarily part of the movement of people who are loosely saying, I am against racism, I am against anti-Semitism, I am against fascism.
Well, if we look at Charlottesville, we can see that the hundreds of neo-Nazis and white supremacists who showed up were clearly looking for confrontation. And if we listen to the accounts from Cornel West and other clergy who were there to participate in civil disobedience, when the time came, the police were not around, and they credited anti-fascists and anarchists with really saving them from serious brutality. So I would encourage listeners, whether they are pacifists or not, to think about the kind of conflicts that emerge between fascists and anti-fascists from a political lens, not simply looking at conflict in the abstract, but realizing that, you know, if you're okay with the fact that in the 1930s it was legitimate for Jews and leftists to fight back against the Nazis, how bad does it have to get before it becomes legitimate? And the anti-fascist answer is you show up to these demonstrations to oppose the far right, ready to defend yourselves, because that was really key in protecting a lot of people in Charlottesville. So I think a political understanding of these kinds of conflicts is really essential.
Well, sure, and I'm not trying to push against that definition. I'm just trying to separate this idea of, I mean, and you did it right in your statement when Cornel West is talking about protection, that he believes he and black clergy who were there to protest and to stand against racism, but who were doing so with the idea of civil disobedience, peaceful civil disobedience. He says they were protected by Antifa, but that's a distinction. That's a contrast, because he and his compatriots were there with the stated aim of not being violent, which is different from
right.
what people who say they
correct.
Are part of Antifa are there for or are
that
willing to do.
That is correct, certainly. And so, of course, anti-fascism is in part about being ready for self-defense, and some anti-racists would not agree with that, and that's fine. I don't think that any anti-fascists are trying to convince absolutely everyone to follow their exact methods. Their argument is rather that, unfortunately, it is a lamentable necessity at times to organize for self-defense. And if we also look at the full range of anti-fascist tactics, we can see that the vast majority of what they actually do that is not always in the headlines is actually nonviolent. It entails essentially functioning like a private investigator, following white supremacist groups, figuring out who their leaders are, and sometimes telling their neighbors, telling their bosses. And we've seen the effectiveness of this after Charlottesville, where some of the tiki torch holding white supremacists have come home to find that their families have disowned them, that their bosses have fired them. And that's a really simple way that anti-fascists put an effective nonviolent anti-fascism into practice to really make white supremacists feel the repercussions of what they're doing.
Mark, what is the demographic makeup of Antifa?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, in part because people that are part of Antifa groups are very secretive. They're very concerned about being infiltrated by white supremacists, infiltrated by law enforcement. And so part of the politics is that they practice what they call security culture in order to really protect their identity so they don't get harassed and targeted. So I conducted over 60 interviews with anti-fascists from 17 different countries. I think about 25 of them were from the United States. And in many cases, I didn't even necessarily know their gender or racial identity, because I spoke to them through encrypted chats or other sorts of formats. So it's hard to say in general, though I will say that it does tend to trend young, as most radical social movements do, and we can certainly see that in the images. But it is far more diverse, both in terms of race and gender, than it may appear. And the other thing that's worth noting,
why do you mean
that?
Why would it be more diverse than it appears?
Well, the mainstream assumption is this is angry young white men. And a number of groups such as Rose City Antifa in Portland and some of the other ones I spoke to are actually predominantly women. And there are a lot of people of color who in their own time some of which also participate in other kinds of social movements, Black Lives Matter, and so forth. So there is a more of a cross-racial dynamic than some media has given it credit for.
Hmm. That idea that it's angry young white men, is said disparagingly, but is there also something to be said about angry young white men who are standing up against other angry young white men?
Well, certainly it is incumbent upon people who would otherwise be the target demographic for white nationalism to do what they can to organize in their communities in any sort of way that they find to be effective, to push back both against the messages that racists are promoting about, you know, making racism great again, and also about short-circuiting the organizing of white supremacist and nationalist groups. And so, yes, in that sense, I'm certainly not disparaging the contributions of white people or men or anything, but it is important to, join together in a broader anti-racist movement. And that is what's happening, because these specifically Antifa groups are actually fairly small, but their kind of perspective on pushing back against the far right is shared by a number of other aspects of this kind of broader anti-racist social movement.
Where does Antifa show up? Is it only a counter-protest movement?
It is largely a politics of response to the far right, but there are, for example, anti-fascist formations that are affiliated with labor unions and political parties that also do organizing in the community in a more of a proactive sense, but they also do educational campaigns. You know, it varies, and in some countries it's more proactive, in other countries it's more reactive, but, you know, without fascism there would be no need for anti-fascism, and so it does have that kind of cycle.
You mentioned that you talked with a lot of different people who are part of the Antifa movement, and you had to use some time in encrypted chats. You didn't necessarily know who they were legally, what their legal names were. How did you get access, and why did they trust you?
Sure. Well, I'm a longtime political activist myself. I was active with Occupy Wall Street in New York City. I've participated in labor organizing and immigrant rights work and anti-war work. And so I have a lot of connections, and also by virtue of being a historian of modern European history, I have a lot of European context, which is why this book focuses on North America and Europe. So basically, I went to some people that I knew and trusted and asked them if they knew people that they could put me in touch with, and in many cases they did. And so through my quote-unquote radical credentials, I managed to navigate some of these circles and speak to some people, often under condition of anonymity, about their experiences and their stories.
Are you a member of Antifa or a sympathizer?
No, I'm not. I'm not a member of any group, and I haven't done this kind of work myself. I'm an activist. I'm a historian. I'm a writer. I identify as an anti-fascist in a broad sense of being against fascism. I sympathize with all those who stand up against the advance of racism and misogyny, but that's not my work.
You've gotten some flack for what has been seen as your at least tacit approval of violent tactics by Antifa. Can you state your position so that we have a better understanding of what you feel yourself about
certainly.
This?
Certainly, certainly. So I come at this historically. I look at what happened and what went right and what went wrong in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And as a Jewish descendant of some people who were murdered in the Holocaust, it's vitally important for me to get the history straight and understand the fact that the many Europeans and really people around the world did not take fascism and Nazism seriously enough from the beginning. And so to me, the importance of being able to organize for self-defense, if necessary, as a last resort, has to be on the table when we think of how to confront neo-Nazis and white supremacists. So my position is not that violence in the abstract is okay, that is always the best method, but rather as a last resort, self-defense is important to protect ourselves and our communities. That's been proven historically. It's been proven recently, given the tragic murder of Heather Heyer, and that's my take. And that is really the anti-fascist perspective, which I greatly sympathize with.
Dartmouth College President Philip Hanlon made a statement on behalf of the college, distancing the college from your remarks or what he says as an advocacy for violence. Some of your colleagues at Dartmouth have started circulating a letter and collecting signatures saying that they disagree with President Hanlon's remarks. And that letter has not been made public yet. It has not been sent to the president's desk, but they are collecting signatures. And they say in that letter that you started receiving death threats after the college's disavowal of your remarks. Is that true, and do you think those two things are connected?
Well, I cannot speak to the motivation of the people who sent me threats, including graphic details of gas chambers targeting my Jewish identity. I cannot speak to their motivations, but the timing is accurate. And I think that the statement that you're referring to by the president grossly misrepresents a very nuanced, historically informed perspective on self-defense that is deeply personal to me as a Jewish person and as a leftist, as someone who identifies with those who suffered and were murdered under the Holocaust. So it's really oversimplifying and distorting what I have to say. And so I look forward to continuing to clarify that I am in favor of free speech. I'm simply against those who are the greatest enemies to free speech, which are fascists. And I am not in favor of quote-unquote violent protest. I am in favor of community self-defense.
We're talking today with Mark Bray, author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. We've been getting some comments coming in online. Alpha16 says, any group that wears masks, helmets, carries clubs, bottles, and other weapons, and engages in threats and violence to silence others' right to free speech is a fascist and a terrorist themselves. Marching under a swastika, a Klan flag, or a Confederate battle flag may be offensive, but it is legal and protected under the First Amendment. The group that calls itself Antifa, along with the anarchists, communists, Workers' Party, and others, were just as responsible for the violence and deaths in Charlottesville as were the Nazis, Klan, and white supremacists. They can deny it, the media can try and spin it away, but the truth is the truth. Both groups arrived from all over the country spoiling for a fight and armed and ready. Sprung 51 says, why did we give these terrorists any publicity, meaning Antifa? I believe that all protests should be without masks. Antifa thinks they're heroes, they are criminals. There would have been no violence without them, and the press would have ignored the misguided folks protesting the statue's removal. And Joe says any group that promotes violence to silence political speech should be denounced by all sides of the political spectrum. I've been very disappointed that many mainstream media outlets have failed to cover accurately the violence of Antifa on college campuses. Mark, I'm going to come to you for a comment in a moment, but let's get one more in here first from Padraic in Plattsburgh. Go right ahead.
Hi, how you guys doing today?
Well, thanks.
Good. You know, I'm calling with a question kind of along the same vein as some of those comments you just read. My first question would be, how can you say that Antifa members are defending free speech when one of the key tactics they use is to shout down their opponents and to negate their rights of free speech? And how can we just or say that they are coming only for self-defense when we look at the countless videos from UC Berkeley, for example, where they are committing acts of violence and not in defense of themselves? I just don't understand how we can say that they are they show up for self-defense when they're clearly showing up for a confrontation.
Padraic, thanks for your call. So, Mark, a lot of pushback against this idea that violence is a legitimate part of this movement.
Sure. Well, yes, very good questions and important points to address. I think that to start, we need to understand the scope of the threat, because I think that even despite all these disagreements, I think we can all agree that white supremacy, fascism, and Nazism are heinous and reprehensible, and something needs to be done to prevent them from growing. We can see historically that when they grow and when they're powerful, you know, if we look at the 1930s in Germany and Hitler's taking power, you know, not a lot of people look back on that and say, you know, say what you will about the Weimar Republic, it certainly granted Hitler a lot of free speech rights. You know, there's a certain point at which when people are being murdered and exterminated where that's not really the point and that's not really what's important. At least it's not for me and it's not for a lot of anti-fascists. Certainly, I think free speech is supremely important, but we also need to recognize that there are other considerations. And one of the considerations is that when white supremacy becomes normalized in society, when it grows, when it threatens communities of color, when it threatens LGBTQ people, and so forth, something needs to be done to stop it. So what can be done to stop it? Certainly, we need to organize against it and recognize that if we simply ignore it, it has the potential of being family-friendly, of expanding and growing. And that may sound like a pipe dream, but we've seen even recently in Europe that some really xenophobic far-right parties have grown rather quickly. In terms of the question of self-defense and violence, anti-fascists see self-defense both in terms of an immediate self-defense and a preemptive self-defense. And it's the preemptive part that I think the listeners are focusing on that is hard for people to understand, but anti-fascists see the existence of white supremacist and neo-Nazi politics as inherently a threat. And for those who have been targeted by them, we can see that, you know, given what they've done, it doesn't make a lot of sense to anti-fascists to wait for them to show up on your doorstep with clubs to beat your door in if you can take the opposition to them preemptively and stop their advance. You know, this is not a game. When we say never again, you know, we should mean it. And that's how they see it. It's an illiberal politics. It's not a politics that sees fascism as an opinion to disagree with. It sees it as a political enemy to oppose. And that differs from a liberal perspective, which has faith in rational discourse to stop Nazism. But we've seen historically that that doesn't always work.
So this idea of self-defense is in some ways more broadly conceived than an imminent threat to physical violence of the individual, him or herself, who is part of the movement.
Correct. Based on the notion that if you allow this organizing to fester, the threat will come to you. And so rather than waiting for it to be powerful, it's better to stop it when it's weak.
Let's go to Ken calling in from Newfane. Hi, Ken. Go right ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Mark, if you might explain the variations within anarchism itself. So much attention gets focused on the black bloc, but there are many different colors really associated with anarchism, and it might help to understand Antifa if, you know, we know more about the various forms of anarchism.
Sure. I can speak to that briefly. As the caller mentioned, there are a variety of different kinds of anarchism, going from anarcho-syndicalism, which is a union-focused anarchism, to green anarchism, which focuses on environmental struggles. And then there are more street tactic-oriented anarchists who perform black blocs to confront their political opponents and so forth. And some anarchists are pacifists, some are not. There's sort of a wide range of it. Certainly the anarchists that participate in anti-fascist struggles come from a variety of these different perspectives, but agree with the notion of sort of creating a pan-left political front with communists and socialists and other leftists to put their political differences aside in the interest of resisting the common struggle, because we can see historically that part of the reason why fascism grew was that inability of different leftists to unite for the same struggle.
Let's go to Chris in Tunbridge now. Hi, Chris. Your thoughts today?
I've read quite a bit around this Antifa movement, and it comes back to communism, it seems, time and time again. I don't support racism in any form, but I'm also staunchly anti-communist. I think communism is as badass fascism. So I would just like the professor's, you know, take on that. Has he heard of Yuri Brezhnev, a KGB defector who spoke about ideological subversion back in the 80s.
Chris, thanks for the call. Mark, did you get all that? So Chris is wondering about, is this just, you know, is this communism? And then,
sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Well, actually, most anti-fascists in the United States and Canada are anarchists, and anarchism differs from Soviet-style communism in its non-hierarchical politics, its rejection of kind of the bureaucratic state apparatus of the Soviet Union. So, you know, certainly people can agree or disagree about that, but it's not a sort of Soviet-style politics for the most part, and I myself am certainly very critical of Stalinism and all the kind of hierarchical oppression that brought with it. But the caller is right that to a certain extent, this specific politics comes back to a social revolutionary view on social change and is not something that those who subscribe to classical liberal views will necessarily agree with.
So what do they see as the end goal? I mean, if they can beat back white nationalism in the United States, at least the Antifa movement here in the United States, or, beat back what they see as the forces of fascism, we'll still have capitalism. We'll still have a capitalistic society.
Correct.
You know, they're still anarchists. So what is the end goal?
Well, you focused on the question exactly correctly. Anti-fascism is predominantly an activity of self-defense against what is perceived as an immediate threat of far-right organizing. So the people that participate in these groups come together for a specific goal, which is to push back against the presence of these kinds of far-right groups in our communities and neighborhoods. They're also people who are, on the rest of their time, union organizers and environmentalists and anti-war activists who are trying to struggle for a better world in different ways. And so ideally, once the far-right is pushed back, these people will simply go back to doing their more sort of proactive political activities, the kinds of things that they were doing, participating in Occupy Wall Street and other kinds of movements that they were doing previously, once this is pushed back. It's not a politics that has an all-encompassing view of social transformation, because within it are people who disagree about what that should look like. They just come together for the common struggle.
Laura is calling in from Bradford. Hi, Laura. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to point out that I heard Cornel West say that the Antifa saved their lives, not just protected them, but saved their lives. And as a person who has had many, many violent assaults on me, I have had to use violence myself in order to protect myself, and other people have had to use violence to protect me. So I really am very distressed by all the pushback. When you look at what is happening, it's so hard for me to accept that people don't understand, when people have genocide on their mind, that you have got to take some action. And there is times when violence is called for in order to protect people. And the idea of those clergy being in that church surrounded by white fascists, you know, with tiki torches, it's terrifying. Just terrifying. And the liberal inability to accept what is happening.
Laura, let me ask you, when you look at Antifa and you are vehemently in support of this idea of being able to defend yourself and defend others who are facing violence, what about the idea or the part of Antifa that is about, for example, shouting down someone like Charles Murray, who is appearing on campus or did appear at Middlebury College, this idea that don't even let people of these mindsets speak? Do you support that approach as well?
The people in Europe that had to deal with fascism passed hate laws, hate speech laws. You can't say things like that in Europe because it happened on their soil and they know where it leads. And I encourage people to look at the Nuremberg trials. I believe it was the Supreme Court judge citing the Nuremberg trials that he was part of to say, when you give the power to the speaker, you give the power to the fascists.
Laura, I really appreciate your perspective. Thank you very much for calling in. Let's get another one in here before we come back to you, Mark. John's on the line from Newport. John, what's your perspective? Hi, John. I can hear you on the line. Are you there?
Oh, sorry. I was from Richmond. But anyway.
Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Not a problem. I guess it leads to the difference between North America and Europe. When I was a student, I had the opportunity to travel in France 40 years ago and was astonished to meet people my age who identified both as communists and fascists. In a normal social setting, it was just kind of like a label. And obviously that's progressed over the years, but they've taken a very different approach. And I was just wondering how that the professor sees the progression in Europe versus the progression in U.S. Regarding attitudes towards political affiliation, towards collaboration, towards compromise, or is it all advocacy and zero-sum game? We've progressed in different ways, and I'm just wondering what his thoughts are.
John, thanks for the call. Mark Bray?
Sure. Yeah, that's a really great question. Certainly, if we look at Europe, there's a greater tendency to see political differences in terms of struggle and conflict. And in the United States, of course, I think we have no less struggle and conflict, but there's a greater tendency to see things in terms of differences of opinion and as sort of the goal of politics to be manage a kind of diversity of thought in a kind of harmonious way, whereas I think Europeans see it more as like whose ideology will win out or have more influence. And of course, the way that you look at it, which of those two you find to be more appealing, will say a lot about your politics. And that's key to understanding anti-fascism, because it grows out of the mindset which says we can agree on or disagree on a whole lot of things. Most of conversation, most of politics, most of life is open for debate and discussion. When it comes to organizing for another genocide, when it comes to denying that black people are human beings, that is not a perspective that we will allow to grow into a movement that will threaten the vulnerable. And we have to see that as a political enemy to be opposed and struggled against, not simply an opinion to be disagreed with.
So in conclusion, Mark, you do see this as a part of a pushback against far-right ideologies, extremism, and white supremacists that is a positive part of the whole mix right now in politics?
It's lamentably necessary to be able to realize that this could go somewhere very dark. And if we don't take it seriously enough now, that could be the repercussion. I think it needs to be treated with the utmost seriousness, and we need to be ready for people who have documented a history of violence from coming at us and being ready to deal with that in whatever way makes sense for us. We can agree to disagree on tactics, but let's all stand up shoulder to shoulder against racism and white supremacy.
That's Mark Bray. Mark is a visiting scholar and lecturer at Dartmouth College and the author of the just out Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Mark, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.